Cubans and Cuban Americans have spent the last four decades staring at each other across the Straits of Florida. And Ann Louise Bardock has spent years meeting people on both sides of that conflict. She's written extensively about what she considers a kind of bitter family feud, and she's published a book about her experience, just as many Cubans hope that confrontation might soon end. Bardock interviewed Cuban President Fidel Castro, and she also met his lifelong enemies who make their headquarters in Miami. Luis Posada Carriles was accused of terrorist acts against the Cuban regime, setting off bombs in Havana nightclubs and possibly even bombing a jetliner. And Luis Bardock met him in a secret location in the Caribbean.
"Let me have your hand," he said, maneuvering my wrist to the right side of his jaw, shattered by the same bullet that had also damaged his tongue and nerves, leaving him with a crushed, gravelly voice. "One bullet entered here, and it exited on the left side. My chin used to be an inch longer. Very nice. I was very handsome once," he said. Posada blamed Cuban operatives for his maiming. A long period of recuperation followed the attack. Then, at 64, he resumed his life's mission, doggedly determined to eliminate Fidel Castro. "It's war. A bad war," he said.
Ann Louise Bardock is the author of Cuba Confidential: Love Inventions in Miami and Havana, and she joins us now from NPR West in Los Angeles. Welcome.
Thank you.
Ann Louise, can you just give me an idea of what the experience has been like to spend a lot of time in Havana, to spend a lot of time in Miami? What kind of connections do you sense between the two places, and what kind of energy do you sense?
I would say the simple answer is that I am overwhelmed in both Cuba and in Miami and throughout South Florida, that the overwhelming majority of Cubans on both sides have had enough of this. It's like, as Juanita Castro says, ya basta. It's enough already. They want to move towards reconciliation. Now, will they say that publicly? Will they say that on the record? They're getting close to that. More and more people will be honest with you about that. But I feel one of the tragedies here is the great silent majority on both of them feel that way, but have been frightened to say so because it's been so politically incorrect for them to say that in Miami and also in Havana. But that is basically the feeling is you get from people when you arrive there is, tell me, when is it going to be over? Did you hear anything? Is it going to be over soon?
I want to bring in NPR's Tom Gelton. He has reported over the years extensively on Cuba. And by way of full disclosure, we should mention that he also reviewed the book Cuba Confidential, which we're talking about here. Tom, this is obviously a conflict that has involved a lot of terrorist acts or alleged terrorist acts, has involved an awful lot of violence. People's view of that sort of violence perhaps has changed since the September 11 attacks in the United States. But I wonder if the conflict in and around Cuba has changed at all.
The fact that some Cuban exiles have been portrayed as terrorists or accused of terrorist acts, I think, probably has more significance now than it did before 9/11. I think, on the other hand, if you look at what's going on in Cuba right now, so much, and I think Anne would probably agree with this, so much of the struggle seems sort of less grandiose than that. I mean, it is so, there's so much energy spent on trying to survive and people trying to figure out, you know, what's in their own best interests. I think the fact that's really important is that Fidel Castro is now 76. And there was this huge debate about Elian Gonzalez going back to Cuba, back to Fidel's Cuba. And I think one of the points that is often forgotten is that Elian is going to grow up in a Cuba without Fidel.
You both have suggested that people on both sides of this conflict seem to understand that Fidel Castro's life must be near an end, that Fidel Castro's rule must be near an end, that things are going to change. Do you think Fidel Castro understands that?
Even though Castro says, I don't care about my reputation, my legacy, he does with every cell in his being. He cares about how he's known.
On the other hand, Fidel seems determined to hold on to power just as long as he possibly can. He actually cares a great deal about his physical well-being and make sure that he's surrounded by doctors all the time. Now, it seems to me that if he really were concerned about his project surviving after his demise, that he would begin delegating some responsibilities and allowing other leaders to emerge. And I don't see much evidence of that happening.
Well, Ana Luisa Bardach, let me ask about that.
Yes.
I suppose there's two different ways you could look at this guy managing his legacy. One is actually trying to continue the Cuban Revolution in some way, and the other is kind of tacitly acknowledging that it's over and just trying to make sure the history books are written in a way that he would like.
I think they're both true. I think Tom is right. Fidel Castro is an obsessive hypochondriac. He is surrounded by doctors. He's very often, all he wants to do is talk about health and about his new drugs. The first time I met him, he was telling me about his cholesterol and about a new drug he had discovered and telling me about his diet. I lately hear from a friend of mine who's in the health ministry that Fidel Castro has gone on a macrobiotic diet.
It's very austere.
It's like brown rice and vegetables, if you can get them in Cuba. I mean, that's another problem. But this just tells you he's willing to go to any lengths to stay alive. He gave up smoking cigars 17 years ago, and we all know no one stops smoking unless they have to. I think he's going to do his utmost to stay alive, if only to spite everybody. And then I also think that he's also working on his legacy in the event that he's out there going deep sea fishing and he has an encounter with a shark or who knows. And he does have a plan in place, I was told by a pretty smart insider, to make sure that his brother would step right up to plate if something happened in the event of illness.
And can each of you also give me your impressions of ordinary Cubans inside Cuba that you've been able to meet in recent years? Can you give me an idea of how openly they are able to speak about Cuba's future after Castro and what you're able to get a sense of that they're actually saying and thinking?
I have found that, I don't know what Ana Luisa's experience is, there's no subject that makes Cubans more nervous than to talk about Fidel Castro.
Of course.
And I'm sure you know there's all these hand movements that you use to refer to him, you know, you sort of tug at your chin to, you know, indicate his beard or something like that. There's a whole kind of nonverbal code to indicate when you're talking about him. I think you quoted Achi Obejas in your book saying that Cubans have a love-hate relationship with Fidel, which is something that I would agree with. I mean, I think on the one hand, Cubans detest him and just can't wait for him to die. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think that there is this kind of grudging respect for him and a sense of, I'm not sure of whether pride is the right word, but a sense that, you know, he has this kind of historical character that they sort of defer to.
I think that's really the case, that the men who really despise him, how they always talk about, but he's a genius. He's a Cuban genius. I think that the conflict comes that they know that Fidel Castro put this Caribbean island on the map.
I want to end this discussion, if I can, in a sense where we began. We were talking about people like Luis Posada, these Cuban exiles who have fought against Castro's regime for almost the entire time that it's been around. I wonder if they're thinking about their legacy, in a sense, and I just wonder if in the end you're able to declare victory after such a struggle like this.
I don't think anyone could do that, because the costs of a 43-year-old Cold War are just have been so enormous that it would be a very empty victory. However, the hardliners in the Cuban exile leadership, for them, there really is only one solution, and that is that Castro has to be captured and hanging from his heels in Little Havana. You know, they want vengeance. But I think for most Cubans on both sides, it's really just enough already. Let's move on. And the embargo, I think, a very prominent Republican conservative Cuban exile said to me, this is 5 years ago, with a man with very close ties to the Reagan administration, said to me, you know, the day they announced the U.S. embargo is over on Cuba, he said, we're going to have 48 hours of screaming on Miami radio. On the 49th hour, we're all going to be down in Havana, visiting families, looking around. It will all be over. He says, there's really no deep roots here except for a very small group. Everybody else is just completely beaten down with fatigue by it.
But then I suppose, Tom Gelton, the really hard work starts.
Right, Steve. There's a point that Ana Luisa makes that is very important, and that's that so many of these Cuban Americans really to this day, even those who have lived here for decades, still feel more Cuban than American. And I think part of their hatred for Fidel is a sense that they've taken, that he has taken Cuba away from them, whether it's taken away their property or taken away a portion of their family or their future or their desire to be buried on Cuban soil. And I think that there will be when Fidel is gone, there will be chapter two, which is we're going to see this drama around Cuba continue for years and years to come.
Tom Gelton is NPR's national security correspondent. Ana Luisa Bardach is the author of Cuba Confidential. She spoke to us from NPR studios in Los Angeles. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.